I hope it's okay if I speak from here. That way we're a little bit closer together. Well, thank you so much for having me here to your beautiful state. Adam and I were glad to get away from Florida. No, my children today told me, Mom, it was freezing. It was 56 today. So that was unexpected for us. We've already been swimming some this year. So today we went snowshoeing, and that was totally different. So I appreciate the invitation to come out and study with y'all. I am passionate about a lot of things, especially involving books. I am teaching English again after many years home with my kids. I'm back in the classroom, and I love, in the meantime, while I wasn't teaching in the academic classroom, I love teaching children's Bible classes and studying with other women. And this summer in our home congregation of Henderson, we had a summer series where we studied women of the Bible. And we had different men from all over the Tampa Bay area come, and they each spoke on different women. And then on Sunday mornings, our ladies got together and would kind of dig in a little bit deeper into what we saw in those women. So I spent the whole summer really involved in a lot of these ladies' lives. But we women noticed something interesting. A lot of the men that spoke, and they did a wonderful job, and those lessons are all on podcast if you're interested in listening to those. But many of them viewed these women as maybe the best supporting actress in the story. It was hard for them to separate Abigail from David, or Hannah from Samuel, or Miriam from Moses. And I understand that. That's pretty normal. But in speaking to my dad about it afterwards, I said, you know, as a young woman, when you get Esther, you cling to Esther, because that's all we get. We get these glimpses of women, but there's not too many books, you know, Esther and Ruth. That's the rest of the Bible is really a story of the leaders of God's kingdom who were male. And so the men that many times deliver lessons to us, they view those women in an important role, but it's definitely a supporting role. And I realized as a young woman, I cling to those little words. It might only be two verses that a woman said, but it's important to me that God recorded their words. And the prayers of these women we're going to study, they're not prayers that I think those women wrote down. They're divinely preserved for us. It is no accident that someone heard Hannah's words, or that the Holy Spirit kept Hannah's words preserved for us. And so I am thrilled that we get to study the words of these women. I hope that they jump off the flannel graph for you, and that you can see them in a real way that maybe you haven't seen before. So we're going to dig in to Miriam tonight. And I love the story of Miriam because I think we can all relate to Miriam. As far as we know from the scriptures we have about her life, she does not have another family that we know about. She could have been married and had children. And if I've missed a scripture that tells me that, please let me know. But otherwise, she is a woman in the kingdom of Israel. And she's a daughter and a sister and a servant and a prophetess. But sometimes in ladies' classes, we focus a lot on our role as wives or as mothers, and I hope that everybody here tonight can find something in Miriam that they can relate to. So let's begin with a really cool verse that I didn't realize even mentioned Miriam in Micah chapter 6 and verse 4. And I have this one on your handout. But in Micah chapter 6, long after God has delivered the people of Israel, it says, I brought you up out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. And I sent Moses to lead you, also Aaron and Miriam. Sometimes I think that Miriam is portrayed as a usurper because of the little scene at the end of her life where she speaks up against her brother. Maybe there's a sense that she took on a role that she didn't have a right to. But this verse lays out pretty clearly that God appointed her. She had a divine purpose in the deliverance of His people. And I think that's significant that that's mentioned again much later in Scripture, and that she is listed as one of the deliverers. So don't second guess how God might use your life in the kingdom because He used Miriam's in a significant way. So what I have for you on that paper is a timeline of Miriam's life. Again, I think of, if you're like me, when I hear Miriam, I picture Miriam and the bulrushes with the basket, and then you don't get much, you know, it's hard to picture, well, how old was she when the rest of these things happened in her life? How old was she when she stood by the river? I'm not sure. But these may not be exact dates. But if you can generally track with me the scriptures about her life and place them in relative age of where she was when each of those happened. So let's dig into Exodus chapter 2, the first time we meet Miriam. And this is probably the most familiar story. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." So this first story, Miriam isn't named. It's just Moses' sister. And she had a big responsibility. When you look at that closely, did someone ask her to go to the river and watch over the basket? No, she's just there. Now, if you are the oldest girl in your family, you probably get this. She's like, "What are you doing with this baby? I've got to look out for him." You know, that's kind of the oldest girl's job. Sometimes we might perceive them as bossy. I am not the oldest. I'm the middle. So I know my older sister was always looking out for us, you know, tattling on us, whatever it was. She always knew where we were and what we were up to that we weren't supposed to be. So Miriam, for whatever reason, maybe she was nudged by the Spirit to get down to the reeds that day, but she speaks up with boldness to Pharaoh's daughter in a time that she's a nothing to this woman. But something in this little girl has courage to speak up and to say, "Hey, I could get a Hebrew woman to nurse her." Imagine how the story of Moses would unfold if Miriam hadn't spoken up. If she hadn't been there that day, if she hadn't said that, if Pharaoh's daughter had said no. But because Miriam's courage and bravery that day by the river, Moses gets to go back to his family for a time and learn the faith of his people. And without Moses knowing who he was and who his God was from Jochebed and Amram, I don't know that he could have been raised up to be the same deliverer. So Miriam's first story is pretty significant. And she saves her brother and gives him back to the family. So then let's look at Exodus chapter 7, verses 1 through 7. And you can look on the timeline at how much time has passed. Then the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your prophet. You are to say everything I command you, and your brother Aaron is to tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites go out of his country, but I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply my miraculous signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it." Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded them. Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. Sometimes we picture Moses younger than that, I think, 80, and Aaron's 83. So I don't know exactly how old Miriam is then, but if she was old enough to talk at the river, she's probably older than Aaron. And if Aaron is 3 years older than Moses, then maybe Miriam, you know, she could have been 5 years older. She could have been 15 years older. She will be the first to die of those siblings, but I would imagine by the time the Exodus happens, Miriam's already in her 80s, at least in her 80s. So on your timeline, we have this whole period of her life where she was a slave. And she is in captivity with the people of Israel. That's how she grew up. And that's her circumstance coming into this. And then her brothers are given very specific jobs. And again, if she's the oldest, the older sister who watches her baby brother, Moses, with this very big job from the Lord, and her next brother, Aaron, who also has a significant task. And you know they will not have an easy time of it. And the Israelites will not always believe them or follow them easily. But Miriam is here in this with her brothers. And so the Exodus begins. In Exodus 15, the deliverance has happened. All the plagues have transpired. And verse 19 through 21 gives us another little picture of Miriam. Could I have someone read that for me? Exodus 15, 19 through 21. Anybody that can be nice and loud? Thank you, Denisa. Exodes 15, 19 through 21.
Oh, that's okay.
For when the horses of Pharaoh, with his chariot and his horsemen, went into the sea, the Lord brought back the waters of the sea upon them. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground in the midst of the sea. Then Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women went out after her with tambourines and dancing. And Miriam sang to them, "Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea."
Okay, thank you. So Miriam here is named a prophetess. And by this point, she's probably still in her 80s because the Exodus, the plagues, that didn't take very long, maybe a couple of months. But now here she is as a leader of the women, at the very least. And notice that she encourages the women to sing to God. It's not just her words to God, it's her words to the women to stir them up to say, "Praise God with me." And so she has this role in the nation of Israel. And you know, sometimes when you have men in a leadership position, the women in his family are naturally sometimes looked to for leadership, whether they are naturally inclined to that or not. Sometimes that's just the cards you are dealt, and you have to step into that role. So Miriam picks up that tambourine, and she gets out there and leads the women in praising God. And I think that gives us a very good glimpse, again, into her ability to lead. Notice they follow. You can't lead if nobody's following you. So the women respond, and they are watching Miriam in her role among the nation. In Exodus 20, the nation of Israel is at Mount Sinai. And Moses and Aaron and the elders go up, and then Moses stays, and then the golden calf. And Miriam hears God speak. She hears the Ten Commandments, and the people are terrified. And she's part of that. So she, in her, maybe her 80s, her late 80s by now, she is experiencing God in a very real way, in a way that I think gives all of the people a reverence that will follow them throughout their time in the desert, and a very personal relationship with God. However, they have the golden calf incident right after this, and Miriam is silent in that story. There's no mention of her participation or her stopping it. So, then in Numbers 12 is the last time that we hear from Miriam. And, you know, she had a really good, strong track record going into it, right? Your timeline is like, yay, good, go Miriam. And then the last story we get of her, you're like, oh. But you know what? That's kind of sometimes how our lives would look if we charted them out. And we might dwell on those negatives, but I think in the whole story, there's a lot of positives in Miriam's life, and I hate that this is the last glimpse that we get of her, but I think there's still a lot we can learn from that. So in Numbers chapter 12, Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he had married a Cushite. "Has the Lord spoken only through Moses?" they asked. "Hasn't he also spoken through us?" And the Lord heard this. Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. You know who wrote that, right? Moses. But I mean, God told him to, but Moses wrote it. So anyway, at once the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out to the tent of meeting, all three of you." So the three of them came out. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud. He stood at the entrance to the tent and summoned Aaron and Miriam. When both of them stepped forward, he said, "Listen to my words. When a prophet of the Lord is among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams, but this is not true of my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak face to face, clearly, and not in riddles. He sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? The anger of the Lord burned against them, and he left them. When the cloud lifted from above the tent, there stood Miriam, leprous like snow. Aaron turned toward her and saw that she had leprosy, and he said to Moses, "Please, my Lord, do not hold against us the sin we have so foolishly committed. Do not let her be like a stillborn infant coming from its mother's womb with its flesh half eaten away." So Moses cried out to the Lord, "Oh God, please heal her." The Lord replied to Moses, "If her father had spit in her face, would she not have been in disgrace for 7 days? Confine her outside the camp for 7 days. After that, she can be brought back." So Miriam was confined outside the camp for 7 days, and the people did not move on till she was brought back. Okay, and then that is the last story that we see of Miriam other than her death, which is mentioned in Numbers chapter 20. So it is hard to track in Numbers the chronology because everything is not given to us in the wilderness wanderings in exact order. But Miriam dies, and then in the next chapter, Aaron dies, and that's kind of the end of the generation that had to die out before they could enter into the Promised Land. So probably by this point, when this story happens, she's in her hundreds, closer to maybe 120. If she lived those, 40, she could be 130. I don't know. But at this point, she still is appearing in this story with her brothers. And they are together known as, she's still a prophetess. She says, "Has God not spoken through all of us?" Sometimes I have heard people say that she was given the leprosy because maybe it was her instigating this against the other woman. I'm not sure that that's fair to the text. It seems that Aaron quickly takes responsibility also for what happened. And it seems more likely that because Aaron's job was high priest, that he probably with leprosy, that would have made his service impossible in the priesthood. And so Miriam is the one that takes this punishment for all of them. But we can always ask when we get to heaven, because I could be wrong. I'm sure there's more to see in that story. But Moses and Aaron plead for their sister to be brought back. And notice while she has the leprosy and she's outside of the camp, what does the nation of Israel do? They wait for her. They wait for her to become clean again, and then she can rejoin them. So you still see Miriam as this pillar in that community. And even though she speaks against her brother's wife, which she should not have done, and clearly she takes on the authority that God has spoken through us, and God was very angry that he said, "No, Moses is different. Moses is my spokesperson, and that's who you should listen to." And so she does overstep her bounds there at the end, and she is punished for that. But all in all, I hope you can see from looking at her whole life that she was a servant to the nation of Israel and to God in that. So that's the timeline part. There is something that I have seen in this story. The more I have studied these amazing figures, historical people that we know about, and it is very rare that we get a glimpse of a family in the Bible where we know so much about all of the family members. But Miriam, Aaron, and Moses have very distinct personalities. And when I became a mother, and I had my first child, and he had a very distinct personality, and so I thought, this is what my kids will be like. And then I had my next child, he was totally different. Totally, almost opposite of that first one. And then I had twins, and you know what? They're very different from one another. So I learned as a mother that sometimes we have natural strengths and abilities and things that seem even from birth to be talents that some possess or interests. And I started studying birth order. I'd actually kind of been fascinated with it even in college. And there is a really good book by Christian psychologist Kevin Lehman called The Birth Order Book. And it explains a lot about, if you've ever wondered why your siblings are crazy and you're normal, or why your husband's family can't get along. No, I'm teasing. But it is a really interesting study into why we sometimes interact with others the way that we do. And when I studied Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, it immediately became clear to me that they are following those patterns. So if you'll follow me on this tangent for just a minute, on your worksheet on the second page, I have a little bit about birth order because I think it really plays into how God used them. And that fascinated me because I think sometimes we might think that all God's servants are the same kind of person. You know, that maybe they're all alphas or they all have this really great public speaking ability. But God can use all different strengths and talents and weaknesses, and we can all be vessels of honor in His kingdom. So, if you don't know anything about birth order, and this is the first time that you're hearing about it, I'm going to be very general in my statements. And if you know a lot about it and you want to discuss it with me, I'd love to talk about that later. But basically, with the idea of birth order, within your family, whatever you are for the first 5 years of your life kind of sets your path for your birth order. That's usually what you'll follow. So if you have a sibling that was born 8 years after you, you still are probably going to function like wherever you fell before they were born. Blended families also have a big, it doesn't follow the rules because they didn't always grow up in the same household. So these are general. Don't get mad at me if you don't like it. It's okay. Maybe you broke the mold. But in general, the firstborn child is usually a very strong people pleaser. They are usually, especially as a young child, obedient, very responsible. This is the one that is dependable, that mom and dad can count on to go make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich while mom changes the diaper on the next baby. They are often the little adult who can engage with adults very easily in conversation. And made to grow up sometimes a little before their time because they're around adults more than the baby of the family is. So those are their positive traits. Their negative traits are that sometimes that firstborn can be bossy. Sometimes they overstep their role. They forget they're a child. And they have a tendency to perfectionism that can be crippling at times because they see how mom does something and they want to be able to do it that way, whereas the secondborn sees how an older kid did it and then that lowers the standard for them. So sometimes they have very high standards. And I think all those things play out in Miriam's life. She's a little bossy. She might overstep her bounds a few times, but she is responsible. She is dependable. She is there when they needed her, and she's consistent in that. So, the middle child, Aaron, the positive qualities of a middle child, they are usually the peacemaker and the mediator in your family. Now, if the firstborn is not at all those traits of firstborn, if the firstborn has a rebellious streak and says, nope, not a pleaser, not doing it, then sometimes that secondborn will take on that firstborn role. And it is often they'll do the opposite of whatever that firstborn does. So if your firstborn is an amazing athlete, your secondborn will probably not pursue athletics because that puts them in head-to-head competition. So secondborn, mediator, peacemaker. They are usually the opposite of that firstborn. They are validated by serving. They usually do not interact with adults quite as much. They're sometimes happier to be background people and often seek careers in service, like teaching, nursing. You can probably guess how many presidents of the United States are firstborn children versus middleborn. I think George Bush Sr. was a middle child. And that's almost like the only one. The rest of them have been firstborns or onlys. Okay, so the negative traits for a middle child, they are very susceptible to peer pressure. If they choose the wrong peer group, that can really be a hard thing for them because they tend to not be as strong of leaders. They can rebel against the family pretty easily, especially if the firstborn does a lot right. Then the secondborn might find their identity in rebelling against that. So those are things to watch with the secondborn. Aaron, what is his job that God gives him to do? He is the ultimate mediator. He is the high priest. His job is to go between the people and God, and to go between Pharaoh and Moses. So God used his natural peacemaking ability to step into that gap. And then what is Aaron's tragic flaw? The story that we go, Aaron, what were you thinking? It's the golden calf. It's when he doesn't speak up, when he doesn't stand up to the crowd. And so because I'm a middle child in my family, I really relate to that story because I can see those things play out in my life. And then finally, Moses. There was a little girl at our school that she had to be the baby of her family. She had a hair bow on the first day of school. Huge hair bow that said, the hair bow said it in puff paint. When God made me, He said, ta-da! And I was like, oh my, you must be the baby of your family. And your older sister probably about smacked that off your head. But the baby has a way of being very charismatic. Oftentimes in a family, the last born is very independent. They do not want you to do it for them. They can do this for themselves. They want to prove it to everybody. And that can make them a very magnetic personality to others. They can have strong leadership among their peers. But usually they do not feel that within their own family. So a lot of them will seek validation outside of the home because they're just a little baby cub to the family, but somewhere else they're class president. So their negative traits are they tend to sometimes be show-offs. They might be very lazy because they may have learned how to manipulate everyone else to do things for them. And they rarely have the perfectionist traits of that firstborn. So sometimes that means sloppy, but of course these are general, and think of these as kids. When you grow up, it's probably not as obvious for most of us. And again, look at Moses. Look at how God used his magnetic personality. He was a very passionate leader, and he reacts with emotion and strength at the times that he is needed. But also his tragic flaw, his story where he makes a mistake, is when he takes credit for himself and he kind of oversteps that place in his and takes credit for what God did. So I think even in those things, it's just, you know, take it or leave it. If you think birth order is hogwash, that's fine. I just thought that was a really cool glimpse. And I know as women in our families, we tend to be the ones that pay attention to these kind of things and to how those dynamics might play out. I grew up in a family with all girls, and it is tricky when you have the same gender, and we're 2 years apart, each of us. So we were very close, and it would have been really easy for that competition to be really strong. And I think my parents did a really good job of nurturing us into being our own people and not always comparing ourselves. But sometimes the world will do that to your kids, even if you don't. They'll say, oh, who's the smart one? Who's the funny one? You know, and can't they all be that? But in the kingdom, I think this story shows us that God will use the smart, the funny, the bold, the brave, the shy, whatever it is that he has gifted you with in your natural personality. He can use that in the kingdom, and he does that with all three of those people. He leads Israel. Miriam really is a strong protector in her family. Now, I mentioned that I love books, and I love all classic literature, but I also kind of like pop fiction too. So there's an interesting motif in a lot of pop literature, Harry Potter, even Twilight, Hunger Games, those teen books, if there's any young people out here that have read those. The strongest power that those women in those stories have is their protection. It's not that they can outfight anybody, it's that they can protect their family. And I think what Miriam does is what we all want to do as women. It's that we will lay down our lives for our people because that's more important to us, is their safety and their protection. When she stands up to and speaks to Pharaoh's daughter, she put herself at risk. But she did that because she saw a value in her family. And that is something that God can use in the kingdom, and that we can bless our families and our spiritual families with that. That sense of, if I could do one thing for you, it's to protect you. And we can't always stop the evil from coming at our families. But we can certainly pray about that. We can certainly be there for them when the hard times come. And if you can channel your Miriam and speak up when it's time, at the appropriate times, I think we'll find power in that, laying down our lives for others. So in our homes, those differences in the birth order can be a compliment to each other. You might think about even your spouse probably has a different, well, they may have the same birth order as you, and that may create conflict. I married an oldest child, and he is very alpha, and I love that because that's what I'm used to. I know what to do with that. So, you know, it works for us. But sometimes you might think, why do I not get along with that other woman? What is the source of our conflict? Well, maybe you're both oldest girls, and you're used to kind of taking charge. And maybe realizing that would help you to be able to step back and view that as a positive instead of a place of friction. Sometimes even in our church, I know in our eldership at Henderson, we've looked at it before, we have like one of every birth order in our eldership, and they work beautifully together because they kind of don't step on each other's toes. So you may just think about that in, when you're on a committee, you know, let the middle child be the secretary. She's okay with that, you know, and if whatever it is, just think about how you can complement other people's roles and how we can use that to build up and find your place to serve. So the last part of that is what we can learn specifically about leadership from the story of Miriam. And I want to go back to Micah because there's, you know, Micah is a great little minor prophet book in there, but we don't study very much. If you know one verse from Micah, you probably know it from Hobby Lobby. Micah 6:8. I had to ask first. I was like, do y'all have Hobby Lobby out here? Because I don't know what. Okay, so Micah 6:8. If you know that verse and we sing a song with that in that. Now I lost Micah in my Bible. Okay. As I was studying that first verse in Micah, I saw down there, I was like, you know, the only other thing I have underlined in the whole book of Micah is Micah 6:8. But I want you to look at how that fits with what we just learned about Miriam. He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And look at Miriam's life and those traits we just talked about. If you said, do justly, what did Miriam do? She stood up for the weak. She understood that her people were oppressed by Pharaoh. And so she is seeking justice. She wants a deliverer. She helps with her little brother. She spoke up when she was needed. She rejoiced when justice was served. And she followed God's law. She was an exemplary person in doing justice. And I think that is kind of that firstborn. That's what usually that are really good at rules. They get that justice part, doing justice. Then loving mercy. Miriam learns when she sees what God is doing with the plagues, and when she experienced the death of the firstborn, and that her people were spared that by their obedience, she saw the mercy of God. She saw God's mercy when the sea opened and they were spared and Pharaoh's army wasn't. And she saw God's mercy even after the golden calf. And he says, I'm going to wipe them out. And Moses gets in the middle and says, please don't spare the people. And she understands that they're only there by the mercy of God. So in leadership, do justice. Love mercy. Nobody will be a leader for long without mercy. If you don't have the grace to forgive people when they fall short of the standard, they're not going to follow you. They will find someone else that can show them that. So don't forget to pursue mercy. And then finally, to walk humbly. And when, again, in Miriam's life, her biggest mistake is when she is not humble. It's when she oversteps where her role was. So when, and God punishes her and reminds us over and over in the Bible, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord and He will lift you up. So humility and mercy and justice are great lessons in leadership that I gleaned from the life of Miriam, a woman who maybe you have spent a lot of time thinking about her before, but if you haven't, I hope the next time you get a chance to teach about her in a Bible class to the children or think about her in your daily devotions or your prayers, that you will see a woman that had a strength and a courage to stand up at the right time and somebody that I think we can learn a lot from. So I look forward to studying more with you tomorrow on some other great women, and thank you so much for your time and participation.